We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal. Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. We are very happy to have back with us again on the program in this hour, May Barenbaum. She is head of the Department of Entomology. She studies ants and other things, as my friend Dennis Barron would say. She is a scientist who studies insects, and she, from time to time, is on the program. And we talk about them. Now, every time we do this, I try to make the same point up front, that when she is here, we don't do extermination. This is love the bugs. We have a guy, Phil Nixon, he was just here last week, who can help you get rid of them if you really must. He, though, is a love the bugs guy and says, and I've always been impressed by him saying, well, really, now, is this really a problem? Can you live with it? If not, okay, we'll tell you what to do. Anyway, that's a different thing. When May is here, we try to have fun and just explore insects and how there are so many different kinds, and they live their lives in so many different ways. And one of the things that I know we have talked about, and I'm sure we'll continue to talk about, is connections between insects and humans, and how you might make the argument that if it wasn't for insects, we might not be here, or at least we wouldn't have the lives that we do now. May is the author of a number of books, and you can head down to the bookstore or wherever you go and buy books, and you might look for things like, for example, her most recent, which is The Earwig's Tale, A Modern Bestiary of Multi-Legged Legends. And then, of course, there is the still classic 99 Gnats, Nits, and Nibblers, published by the U of I Press. That's been out for a long time now, like since when? 1989.
Yeah.
And so she has written popular stuff. She, of course, has written a lot of scientific and scholarly material. And any sorts of questions that you might have, particularly if it has to do with, say, a particular insect, if you can give us a description, give us the very best description that you can, she may then be able to say, oh, yeah, I'll tell you what that is. Other questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Thank you very much for being here.
Always a pleasure.
Once again. Now, we have some callers, and we'll get to them. But one thing I do just quick mention, and we can talk about it some more, that I think is really cool, is that you have said that your department now, for the first time in a very long time, you're going to be doing a course for people who would like to become beekeepers.
Yeah, this is an academic course. As far as I can determine, the last time beekeeping was taught on our campus, not as a short course, but as a full-length course, was prior to 1979. So it's at least been 30 years since we've taught beekeeping. We have a summer session 2 course that we're offering, and it's for university credit, and it's not just how to keep bees, but all about the lives of bees. And we thought it was an important course to offer, given the fact that in the last quarter century, the number of beekeepers in the U.S. has plummeted and reduced by more than 50%. And beekeepers, of course, are the ones that deliver bees, and bees are now utterly essential for pollination services. At least 90 crops depend on honeybees for pollination services, and the beekeepers deliver those bees. So our whole agricultural enterprise depends on bees, which depend on beekeepers. So this is our effort to help deal with the crisis conditions in the apiculture industry.
And if people would like to learn more about this, can they go to the entomology website?
Yeah, there's a link on our department webpage.
So. Okay, very good. Let's talk with some callers. We'll get right into it. Talk with someone over in Indiana. Line 4. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. A couple of things. I've been spending these last nice few days on my balcony trying to see what insects I can see as the sun is real low in the sky, so you get that beam and the glitter effect. I was surprised at the number of little fellows out there. But the main thing that got to me is I expect wasps and other wasp-like insects to, sort of go up against the siding, look for holes or whatever places they can put the nest, however you want to call it that. And all of a sudden I see these bumblebees. I mean, the big boys, not the little bumblebees, but the big bumblebees, three of them, in fact, were doing the same thing. None of them ever actually went under the siding, but they stopped a few times, and of course they were doing things which I couldn't see. Then they would fly off. So there's two things there. First, I didn't know bumblebees flew at that height. I'm probably, at my stand up, I'm probably 20 feet off the ground. And they were at my level and a few feet above it. And that surprised me because as a little boy, I used to tumble around looking for the burrows in my grandmother's garden. And I didn't realize they went that high. So I wondered if you had some idea, just a generalization about good old nibblers and gnats and stuff, just how high they get. I mean, the wind started getting pretty crazy up above 25, 30 feet in places.
Well,
and I was just wondering about that.
Well, two things. First is what you're seeing, if they're poking around the siding, they're not bumblebees. They're very similar. Bees that are similar in appearance, they're actually not even related to they're distantly related. They're called carpenter bees, and a whole different subfamily from the bumblebees. And the carpenter bees are called carpenter bees because they like to tunnel through wood. I guess human carpenters don't exactly tunnel. They work with wood, and they look for particularly wood that's a little bit soft or, sort of maybe affected with, some sort of fungal damage. And that's where they build their nests, and they'll carve it out. They're not social bees like bumblebees. They don't make nests with a queen and many workers. What they do is they're solitary bees. So they one female will carve out a lot of little chambers and lay her eggs there. And so they'll excavate these tunnels up to a foot long, and separate the cells, each individual cells, and each will have an egg in it and little – actually, they make kind of a cement to make the walls of the cells. And they'll provision those with a mix of pollen and a nectar. So those are the carpenter bees rather than the bumblebees, and they're always out very early. And they're big. I mean, one way you can tell the difference, they're bigger than your average bumblebee. And they also have this sort of naked, shiny black butt. Bumblebees tend to be a little hairier. Now, and it's funny that you ask how high do they fly, because I actually just wrote an article about, I called it frequent flyers. And this has been a question that has bedeviled entomologists for at least a century. People have wondered how high you can find insects and whether they're actively flying or whether they're carried up as sort of aerial plankton. And every time a new flying device gets invented, somebody puts a net on it to try to figure out. And you can actually collect insects a mile above the they've been found even higher than I've found at heights of 15,000 feet. Usually they're small and probably windborne, but there are active flyers that go fly at considerable heights. I don't think I don't remember any bumblebees in those particular collections, but you're not the first to wonder.
Yeah, well, good. I still should become an entomologist. It really tears me up.
Never too late.
Those days are all over now. it'd be nice to come over. I've thought about being a beekeeper, too, because let's face it, the bees are in trouble in our country. I keep getting letters from Xerxes, your group.
Yeah.
Some other people who's, my mail's been sold around. And sounds pretty frightful to me, actually.
The situation,
not
the
bees. I'm so glad the Mayflowers are out, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Well, it's not too late to become a beekeeper, so.
I know. I'm looking into it.
That's great.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Let's go to next caller, and that would be Belgium. Line one. Hello.
Hello, and good morning again. I'd like to talk to you a bit about a couple of things. First off, it's back into black fly and buffalo net.
Yep.
Oh, my goodness, folks. They are getting more and more numerous all the time. Over near the Spoon River, they will they will cloud around your head and just make it so you cannot stand outside. It's amazing. I don't want to badmouth insects, but they're not pleasant. But the one I wanted to really talk to you about and discuss a little bit is, I'm not sure what to call a couple of different insects. Now, in the fall, when we're drinking soft drinks and stuff, there's an animal, a small insect that gets into your soft drinks and likes sugar, and people call that a wasp. I don't know if it's a wasp or not. Also, here in the springtime, and this year I've noticed a lot more than I have in the past, the insects that have a bulbous front, a bulbous back, and a little thin tube that connects the two of them and have several wings, and they are called wasp also. And then we hear about a hornet. Now,
what's the difference?
Yeah, what do we call what?
In terms of what's crawling into your drink, it could very well be a wasp. Yellow jackets are wasps.
That's
people
what I mean.
People don't think of them as wasps, but they are, in fact, card-carrying, legitimate. No pockets on a wasp, but they are legitimate members of the same family as hornets are, actually. And they just have a different common name. They are real garbage hounds, and that's why you'll find them in, kind of late summer, early fall, anything with any kind of sugar at all, and they are attracted to that. And hornets are just kind of a sort of larger version of yellow jackets, but, our local bald-faced hornet isn't yellow and black. It's kind of white and black, and that's another kind of wasp. Hornets tend to – they'll build those papery carton nests up in the trees. Yellow jackets actually nest in the ground, another thing that people don't recognize as a difference. Wasps are really amazingly diverse. There's another one that gets a lot of attention later in the season are the giant cicada killers. They're also wasps. They're the largest wasp, actually, in eastern North America. Those look like sort of, I guess, yellow jackets on steroids. They're quite big. They're, about an inch and a quarter in length. And they nest in sandy. They like sandy soils. They're not social like the yellow jackets or the hornets. They don't form these large nests with hundreds of individuals in them. Paper wasps, there are all kinds of usually if it's striped and it has, I hate to sound, self-fulfilling, if it has a wasp waist, if it's wasp waisted, it is probably a wasp.
Well, that's what I don't really understand. The ones we see in the fall look more like honeybees in a way. A lot of people confuse them for honeybees.
Yep.
And the ones I'm talking about here in the spring are literally the ones that are all black.
Yep.
And they're real, like one hard body, no fuzziness on them at all.
Very shiny.
Very shiny. And this year they seem to be a lot of them, more than I seem to have seen in the past, because they seem to be every place this year. But you call those wasps also. They're not a hornet.
Right. Hornet, I mean, that's the trouble with common names. Everybody kind of uses them loosely, and they're not the same from one country to another. But, in fact, even the name wasp covers a lot of different families. And the shiny black ones that aren't very hairy, those are kind of the most basic fundamental basic body plan wasps, like in the family Sphecidae, the sort of ancestral family. And they're mostly, or exclusively, actually, solitary. They don't make those big giant nests like the yellow jackets and the hornets do. But, you don't have to have stripes to be a wasp. You don't have to have – in fact, most wasps don't have much hair. It's one way you can tell wasps from bees. Bees are hairy. Bees have branched hairs. They look especially hairy. And those branched hairs are really important for carrying pollen. In fact, they sort of get electrostatically charged, so it helps to keep the pollen on the hairs. Wasps, not so. I mean, there's a few wasps with hairs, but not those branched hairs. So if you want to get really close, that's how you can tell the difference between a bee and a wasp. Most people aren't that interested.
I'm not. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And that, so wasps, they don't do pollinating like bees do?
There are wasps that pollinate. In fact, some of the other families that we don't have around here are the exclusive pollinators of certain orchids and other plants. They are not sort of – they're more generalized. They're not quite so – see, if you're a solitary species, you don't have the enormous job of bringing food home for, you know, 50,000 relatives. So that's why bees in particular, like honeybees or bumblebees that live in colonies with hundreds or in the case of honeybees, thousands of relatives, you have to be really, really good at bringing a lot of food in. So that's so much for the wasps that don't really – and also our local yellow jackets and hornets are feed on all kinds of things. They're mostly carnivores. They feed their kids like masticated caterpillars and other prey. Yeah, so kids, don't complain about whatever your mom packed for lunch. It could be masticated caterpillars.
Yeah.
Oh, and the black shiny was spider wasps, which was Sphecids, or the organ pipe mud daubers eat spiders. Well, they'll feed their – they'll provision their offspring with spiders, mashed spiders. So.
Cool.
Yeah, we should come up with a wasp cookbook. That would be recipes for baby wasps.
Okay.
Won't be a big seller.
May Barenbaum is here. She's the head of the Department of Entomology at University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign, and occasionally is here, and we talk about insects and try to enjoy them and appreciate them, not so much get rid of them, but live with them. Now, that's the idea. If you have questions, call us, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Oh, by the way, you can send us email, will-talk at illinois.edu. Next caller is, in Urbana, line two. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I am calling with a follow-up report on your advice. We consulted the website Singing Insects of North America.
Uh-huh.
And I'm pretty sure that the very noisy insect I called you about the last time you were on is the common virtuoso katydid.
What a great name.
And I want to thank you for pointing me in that direction. And it helped, I think, answer my little question there.
Well, that's great. And what a wonderful backyard insect to have, a virtuoso katydid.
And if folks around here hear that thing, they're not out making noise yet, but in the full dark, late summer, that's the noisy one.
Yeah, and they're really loud.
Yes.
They're stupendously loud, and they're maybe about the size of a grasshopper.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they're not terribly big, but, man, they can make a lot of noise, yeah.
Okay, goodbye.
All right,
thank you.
And that's, I think the caller called in and said he was hearing this insect and really wanted to know what it was. And I think your suggestion was, well, there are websites that you can go to where they have recordings of insect sounds. So you can listen to them and see if you can figure out that way what it is.
Yeah, and, many of these are so distinctive that you would recognize it instantly. And it sure beats me sitting at the mic and trying to do impressions.
Well, I remember one time when we were in Gregory Hall, I brought in some sandpaper because I had one of the I think I sort of had the same question. And I said, well, what is this? And the only way that I thought I could demonstrate it was taking two pieces of sandpaper and rubbing them together in front of the microphone. And you said, oh, yes. But then you took the sandpaper. And I said, it was kind of like this. And you took the sandpaper and say, but was it like this? We were rubbing sandpaper.
Meanwhile, listeners all over the two-state area
wrong
are scratching
with these
their
people.
Heads. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, okay. Well, that's good. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And we have some other Urbana callers here. Line one in Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello.
Yes, I'm interested in how carpenter bees do their job. I assume it's by chewing, but they're so straight in their bore holes, and in fact they can do right angles. I've noticed in 3/4-inch boards. Do they use enzymes as well, or what? You know, how does it happen?
Well, that's actually a really good question. A lot of insects are astonishingly good at precise dimensions. When Asian longhorn beetles, for example, first started showing up in Greenpoint, in the Greenpoint neighborhood of Brooklyn, people thought that the perfectly round holes throughout the maple trees on the streets were the work of vandals with some tools because they were so uniform. They don't have any special tools other than their mouth parts, and it might just be a function, the limitation on morphology is destiny, I guess, that they really are limited by the shape of their mouth parts with the sort of tunneling they can do. I don't believe – that's one reason that they like wood that is not fresh and completely intact. If you're on a porch or a balcony or something, it's wherever it's a little bit softened and it may be sort of there may be some resident fungal or microbial growth that they do much better in these places. And it's one reason they, you know, if you get rid of them, they'll come back. The others will come back and build in the same place because, you know, just like every other kind of real estate, location, 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 everything about the boards appeals to them. But I don't think there's been a lot of work done on, research on their behavior, at least in part because they're not sort of intractable pests. They're not like Formosan termites that are structural pests. So unless it causes people a lot of trouble, most entomologists don't spend a lot of time. At least I don't know that literature. But I think in the case of most boring insects, and I don't mean,
not
mind-numbing, that their mandibles kind of – mandible gape determines a lot of what they're capable of digging out.
Yeah, well, it was cedar or redwood in either case, and I guess that is a little bit softer. And so I assume that harder woods, they're less inclined to go after.
Yeah, and I think Phil Nixon probably – if he got any questions last week about them, this is the time of year they're very active. But you can also put various sorts of coatings on to discourage them.
I think he would say that, yeah, if you have wood that's vulnerable, that if you paint it, that should – help discourage them. I'm not sure that penetrating stains do quite as well, but if you paint over it, that they say, and also they say that they won't attack treated wood, but of course they do. They didn't read that. Yeah.
All right. Exactly. Well, they were very efficient, but we've got moved to a different place, so they don't have that advantage anymore. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
On to Urbana, line two. Hello.
Yes, let's continue with the carpenter bee theme for a sec here. Mm-hmm. A couple weeks ago, redbud tree in the backyard was blooming pretty nicely, and I noticed 40 or 50 round black carpenter-looking bees hovering above. And I knew some of them were carpenter bees because their flight trajectory, they seemed to kind of dart in straight lines. But other ones weren't doing that. I'm wondering, those bumblebees that look a lot like carpenter bees or vice versa?
Bumblebees and carpenter bees look very similar. Again, it's the sort of you can differentiate if you get really, really close. carpenter bees are solitary, and bumblebees are the ones with these elaborate nests with 300 to 400 or 500 workers in them. And if you look at the back legs of a carpenter bee, they do not have the pollen baskets that bumblebees have. Bumblebees need to bring a whole lot of pollen back all the time, and their hind legs are structured so they can actually sort of build little pollen packets and carry them around like little pollen suitcases. And you don't see those on carpenter bees. And then there's the sort of distribution of abdominal hair. Generally, black shiny abdomens are carpenter bees, although, we have a site called Bee Spotter, which we're trying to sort of track the abundance of bumblebees across the state of Illinois. Every now and then we'll get a photo uploaded, and it's hard to tell whether it is a carpenter bee or hair-challenged bumblebee. Bumblebees actually, as they get old, they tend to lose their fuzziness. So sometimes they end up wear and tear, looking a bit like carpenter bees. But you can always tell by those back legs.
Right. And just another thing, too, just to follow up on that. In a burrowed hole, when a carpenter bee goes inside, lays the eggs, how many eggs typically, how many will come out of that batch?
Let me see if I can cheat here and look. It's not a large number, but whether it's half a dozen or a dozen, I'm not exactly sure. Several.
I thought it was in the range of like maybe 7 to 10.
Yeah, that's
something
I can't
like
remember
that.
If it's half dozen or a dozen. So maybe it's between. So, but it's not like in a bumblebee nest you could find 300 offspring. So,
right, and so the bumblebee nest, where were they typically located?
They're also ground nesters, but they like abandoned rodent burrows. They like sort of prefab housing. That's one reason a lot of bee conservationists are suggesting you actually can provide housing for bumblebees to encourage them. They'll move into an abandoned mouse nest, for example, and set up shop in there. The carpenter bees, by contrast, in view of their name, are a little more handy with building materials.
Hey, and just the last thing. Carpenter bees, they don't sting or they do sting?
They are capable of stinging, but they're not nearly as likely to sting. The reason bees sting in general is that they are defending their nests. So it's the social species that have this behavior. People, you look at a bee, you're not going to ask what its social life is. But in general, the ones that people get stung by are honeybees and bumblebees defend their nests, and this behavior is defensive. So the less sophisticated social life of a particular hymenopteran, bee, ant, or wasp, well, all ants are social, the less likely it is to sting you. But if you grab one in your hand or you insult its mother or whatever, irritate it, you can get stung.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot.
All right. Thanks. That was actually a question that came up when Phil was here the other day. Someone called in and said that in an area of their garden where they really wanted to be working, there were a lot of bees and they were the kind that burrow in the ground. And that the person said they were really afraid to go out there and to try to work because there were all these bees and they were afraid of getting stung and they wanted to know, well, can I do something to get rid of them? And Phil essentially said the same thing. He said, well, these are not social bees. These are solitary bees. And that for that reason, in their own defense, they're not particularly aggressive because it doesn't really make sense. It would make more sense for them just to want to get out of your way. And he said, actually, if you can do it, if it doesn't bother you to have them buzzing around, he said, just go in there and go in your garden and go about your business and they'll go about theirs, and that they really shouldn't bother you.
These are probably the colletids. They look a lot like honeybees, and they tend to find the same little patch of real estate to set up their nest, but they're not interacting with each other. They're not related to each other, but people see this cloud of bees and assume the worst. I think I've probably told this story about the Oregon pipe mud daubers on our front porch. Sort of the entomologist view of the world and the real and the view of the rest of the world. We had these lovely nests of Oregon pipe. They make these. They're called the Oregon pipe mud daubers because they construct pipe nests. They're sort of pipe shaped, like the pipes of an organ, and each one of these cells has, they're partitioned and they're provisioned with these mashed up spiders, it's fascinating to watch them going in and out and see them build these beautiful structures. And I came home one day and my husband, who is a film professor, knocked them down. I'm like, why did you knock down the – they don't sting. I mean, you have to really – they were on our front porch and he pointed out that, we have visitors. Well, they're not going to sting the visitors. And he said that the visitors don't know that. So even if they don't sting, they may see the wasp, panic, and then trip over the steps. And then
you'll get sued.
And then we'll get sued. So that's why they got knocked down.
Okay. Leave it to Richard to figure that all out. Questions welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Our guest is May Barenbaum. She's a professor and head of the Department of Entomology here at University of Illinois. And insect questions, not getting rid of them, appreciating them. That's what we're about here this morning. Charleston is next. Line three. Hello.
Oh, is that me?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I have a question about a particular wasp I've seen only a few times. It's a gunmetal blue about an inch long. And I saw this wasp one day at a quarry sting this wolf spider, I guess it was.
Mm-hmm.
Dig a hole, take the wolf spider in the hole, and I guess I assumed that it laid eggs in the wolf spider's body. That's all I could figure what it was doing.
Yep.
I watched it for maybe an hour or two, and then it flew away. And when it lands, it flits its wings it stops, and then they flits. It walks around on the ground, and it flits. And it was amazing what. You know what I'm talking about?
Absolutely. Well, there's one of several things. Those gunmetal blue colors. These are, among other things, they're Sphecid wasps. That's the family name. The mud daubers I was just talking about, many of them are just solid black, shiny metallic black. There's also pompilids. They're called spider wasps that are also the sort of shiny blackish blue, and that's exactly what they do. They will collect spiders or sting the spiders and usually paralyze them. So I'm not sure they're necessarily laying eggs in the bodies like a parasitoid would, but paralyzing them and bringing them back to the nest to eat the the paralyzed spider that was provided. So this family Pompilidae, these are all spider wasps. One of the big species out west is called a tarantula hawk. And although they are, they're metallic blue, and don't think they're, the tarantula hawks aren't around here, but most spider wasps are black and with this definitely gunmetal type color, long legs, very active, and
are they solitary or do they have a community of some type or are they solitary?
They are, but some of them are what are called social parasites, and they will go into the nest that's been provisioned by another spider wasp and just lay their eggs there. So if that's sort of antisocial behavior, not social behavior. No, they don't have these large nests like hornets or honeybees or other truly social species.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, right, great observation.
Let's see, and we'll go next to Savoy. Line one, hello.
Hello.
Yes.
My question is about flies. Are they insects?
Oh, you bet, yeah.
Okay. These flies are found by the hundreds up in the attics or in the windows of upstairs of old abandoned farmhouses. And I was wondering what kind they are, what they use as food and water supply, since they apparently don't have any source within the house.
Is this in the winter when you see them?
Well, they all year round.
And do they look kind of housefly-ish?
They're large. And they're black, and they're just swarms of them.
My guess as what they are, the typical large, blackish, sort of housefly-ish-looking fly you find in houses in large numbers are called cluster flies.
Uh-huh.
And they're actually in a different family from the houseflies. They have a very strange, they overwinter in houses. They're the ones that end up, you'll see in the spring, sort of buzzing endlessly in the corner of the window around and around. Like you've seen that behavior. Those are cluster flies. You can hear, it's an audible buzzing sound, and, they're big and they have, unexpected. You ask how they make a living. Well, they don't eat anything during the winter months as when they're in this sort of hibernation-like state called diapause. They're not sort of hibernating like a bear does. They're just a reproductive diapause. But when they start getting active in the spring, they'll fly out of whatever structure they're overwintering in, and they visit flowers. They'll feed on nectar, and then the females will actually lay their eggs in or on near the anus of earthworms. And the maggots crawl in, and they're parasites of earthworms. So that's how they make their living, and it's a very they're very strange.
And they where do the new flies hatch out then in the house?
Oh, they don't. They come in. Usually, they'll get into the house when it starts getting cold outside, and then they're not clever enough to figure out how to get out.
So. What's a good way to get rid of them? Kill them?
Wait, they just die. I'm not the expert on how to get rid of them, but they're not really going through. If they are cluster flies, they're not going through their life cycle in your house because they, unless you have earthworms in your house, which I don't think. It's just they're kind of, they went in there for shelter and they get lost and they stay in there and annoy people, but they're really pretty harmless.
Okay, thank you much.
All right, thank you.
They're actually pretty good pollinators of some of the flowers they visit.
Yeah, but if they get stuck in your house, they're not doing that either. All right. Ottawa, next, line 4. Hello. Is there a caller there in Ottawa?
Hello?
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I think we got a bad connection. Maybe the caller would try to call us again. We'll see if we can get him in here. Here's something that's come in through email. Let me ask you this question. Listener wants to know, is there any evidence that insects can form superorganisms?
Actually, I have a colleague at the University of Illinois who's kind of an expert on that subject. Kind of depends on what you call a superorganism. Some people might consider the very structured colonial behavior of honeybees to be equivalent to a superorganism, because really the individual workers don't reproduce. It's only the queen who reproduces. But if you, in a grander sense, if you think of a superorganism, Argentine ants Argentine ants, Lunapithma humili is their name. They're native to Argentina, but here in the U.S., their biology has undergone a kind of a transformation. What happened is sort of their genetic diversity was filtered as a consequence of being introduced here. And all along the west coast of the U.S., there isn't enough genetic difference among colonies for them to engage in defensive behaviors. Usually one colony will recognize other colonies as alien or unrelated, and they'll have Argentine ant fights and the like. But what's happened throughout the western U.S., they form sort of a super colony that can be miles in extent. Hmm. And that's one reason they're incredibly successful invaders, because usually the families, the colonies are restricted to related individuals, but these share enough genetic similarity that they don't attack each other, and collectively they basically overwhelm any other ant species in the neighborhood. But strictly speaking, the model of superorganism, where each individual acts like a cell of an organism, that's been applied to the eusocial, the truly social species, like the honeybees and the bumblebees.
Of all of the bees, how many fall into each category? How many, roughly speaking, how many are social and how many are solitary?
Way more are solitary than social. Let's see. Depends on who you talk to. There may be 7 to 12 species of honeybees, depending on who you talk to. There are, I know there's 49 species of bumblebees in the U.S., and I don't think I should probably check, but it's in the hundreds worldwide. And collectively, there's about 17,000 species of other bees. So,
and most
solitary
of them,
is the rule.
Most of them are solitary.
Yeah.
Well, I wonder in my yard, for example, in the springtime, in the early spring, there are a lot of things that bloom. and like Scylla, we have lots and lots of Scylla and other sorts of things. And there are certain points where the ground is just thick with bees. They're very, very excited. And I'm happy for them to, you know, to be excited. And I wonder about that and wonder, you know, how am I just seeing a whole lot of a small number of different kinds of bees? And then are most of those bees that I would be seeing solitary bees? Or are there some bees there that, in fact, could be?
This time of year, it tends to be the solitary bees that appear first. It takes some time. In fact, the overwintering, the way a bumblebee colony works, it's only those colonies are annual, not unlike the honeybee colonies, which are perennial. It's the queen lives and all workers spend the winter. Annual, the bumblebees, the solitary, the queen comes out and she's essentially solitary, but then she will raise offspring that become the workers. And then ultimately, the colony will build up in size. So it takes time for bumblebees in particular to get their numbers up. There are other social bees in some of the other families, and probably the most individuals. If you count individual bees, because of the enormous size of these social insect colonies, they probably outnumber the solitary bees. But in terms of species, there's just more solitary bees.
And then where do they all go? Because once those blooming things are done, I feel that I don't see them
as much. They're early. A lot of them are early season, and they're just done for the year. It's just kind of they pack it in and wait for the next spring.
So. Okay. Some other callers here. Let's talk with someone in Charleston. Line one. Hello. They're calling their line one.
Yes, I am.
Yes, go ahead. We got you. Go ahead.
Hey, I got pictures, bad ones, of a bee bug of some sort that I saw down in Louisiana, and it's very large, at least an inch long, with a shiny black back end. I mean, it just shines, and the rest of it is bumblebee color.
Yeah, that sounds exactly like a carpenter bee. We were talking about this earlier this hour. Yeah, if it's like a bare butt that's shiny black and the front half looks like a bumblebee with yellow colors and fuzz, then it's probably a carpenter bee.
Oh, man. Okay. I guess it's the first time I've ever seen a carpenter bee then. Okay. Thanks.
All right. Yeah. Very good.
Thank you.
We'll go on here to line number two. And this is someone in Pasotum. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Hello.
I think last year there were little teeny, they looked kind of like seed pods floating around like a little teeny cotton ball, but they had little wings. And I was thinking it was in the spring, but maybe it was more summerish. Do you have any idea what those might have been?
Well, last fall we were invaded by soybean aphids.
Right. I had swarms and millions of those. Yeah. But these are, I think this would have been earlier, and they just looked like a miniature cotton ball or like a dandelion. But I thought, what's all these seed pod things flowing around? But they had little teeny green wings, and they weren't not much bigger than a pinhead or something, I guess. But
well, there are a lot of tiny sucking insects that sometimes have sort of white fluff on them. They're called jumping plant lice or psyllids. I'm not sure they look like dandelions, but...
It's like a little, they didn't look, if you really miniaturized a dandelion, it was just like a little teeny cotton ball kind of thing floating around, and I noticed it had little teeny green wings, so they were going directional, but the only time I'd ever seen them.
Well, I would guess maybe that they are the psyllids or the jumping plant lice that can be quite small. Sometimes are sort of powdery or dusty. There are woolly aphids as well.
It could have been because they were about a little. They're a little bit bigger than regular white aphids, but.
Yeah, a lot of members of the aphid family, or the woolly aphid family, are capable of producing these sort of waxy fluff on their bodies, and that might look like cotton. They like so many regular aphids can produce huge populations and would look, I think, as they're winged, they have fluff, little waxy bits of tufts on their back end. So that could be what you were seeing.
Okay, well, if I see them again this year, I'll pay more attention and call you back next time you're on. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
We have maybe about 5 minutes left in this part of Focus with Mae Barenbaum. She's head of the Department of Entomology at UVI. If you have insect questions, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and you can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. I don't know how complicated it would be to do this, but I think probably every time you've been here in the last couple of years, one way or another, we've talked about bees and also talked about colony collapse disorder and what over time scientists like you and some of your colleagues here at the University of Illinois have learned about what's happening with the bees. And as you discussed earlier, there's a big concern about the health of bees, particularly honeybees, because they're so important as pollinators. Have you been learning anything new recently about this?
Well, I think I've talked before, we did a study here at University of Illinois that suggested that one problem that might be afflicting bees with colony collapse disorder is that they are infected with multiple viruses. It's not unusual. There's a whole group of viruses that appear to afflict only bees. And bees can handle these viruses, but when they are hit with multiple infections, their defense system seems to break down, and we found these fragments of a cell structure called the ribosome, which is what makes proteins. So their protein-making capacity presumably is compromised by these viruses which specifically attack the ribosome. That's characteristic of all of these bee viruses. That's one problem. And there is a group at Penn State who's discovered why are they getting these multiple viruses? That's a good question. A group at Penn State has recently been able to demonstrate that they may actually be picking these things up from the environment, that sick bees can contaminate pollen on flowers so that subsequent visitors can actually – it's kind of like, you know, not washing the surfaces, you know, when we, you know, and picking up viruses from surfaces. So there's a lot of concern about the sources of these viruses. People suspect that they might be this international sales of bees, movement of bees across borders may also be moving viruses in a manner that's really without precedent. So bee viruses are big news. Another study recently showed contamination by over 121 pesticides and other synthetic chemicals in a survey of beehives. Bees have been called flying dust mops because of the electrostatically charged hairs pick up not just pollen but all kinds of stuff. So they fly through all kinds of environments and bring back whatever they flew through to the hive. And with sensitive chemical equipment, you can detect residues of all kinds of pesticides, and it's the honeybees are not particularly well endowed with defenses against pesticides. They're not particularly resistant to these, and they are especially sensitive to combinations of poisons. So they're living in this sort of these toxic buildings now just because of their exposure in agricultural fields and even inside the hive where beekeepers have been treating them for the varroa mite. About the only way that anyone can deal with this parasite of honeybees is to kill it with a selective pesticide that kills mites more than bees, but it's not really good for bees either. So the bees, it may not be clear exactly what causes or what is colony collapse disorder, but the last couple of years has shown that bees are facing some pretty daunting challenges these days.
Yeah. We're pretty much at the point where we have to finish, and I have to apologize. I invited calls, and we have a couple of people that we can't take. I'm sure later on in the summer, May would be happy to come back. Just again, because it hooks up with what we're talking about there, I do want to mention one more time, because I think this is pretty cool, the fact that, as you explained in the beginning, that in your department this summer, you'll be offering a course for beekeepers. And it sounds like this is going to be quite a comprehensive kind of thing.
Yeah, it's not just how to keep bees, and there are short courses on how to keep bees, but this is all about honeybees, the life and times of Apis mellifera.
And if people would like to learn more about that, they can go to the website of your department, of the Department of Entomology.
And one quick plug, we're coming out. Our department's put together a honey cookbook, University of Illinois Press. It's called Honey, I'm Homemade, Sweet Treats from Around the World and Through the Centuries, words to that effect. And it's going to be available in August, and all proceeds will support our University of Illinois Pollinatarium.
And otherwise, if you'd like to read some of May's writing, you look for her books like The Earwig's Tale, Bugs in the System, Buzzwords, Scientist Muses on Sex, Bugs, and Rock and Roll, and the immortal, still available, 99 Gnats, Nits, and Nibblers by May Barenbaum. She is the head of the Department of Entomology here at the University of Illinois. Thank you very much.
Thank you.